Sports-specific training, it's certainly a big word going around now, and you probably see on the news or sports shows when they film different sports training, they're doing all sorts of training methods, from sprinting in and out of witches' hats to playing leapfrog over ladders and jumping over fences and bounding up and down and all sorts of crazy stuff. And some people say, I wonder what they're doing. And I sometimes wonder that myself. So let's have a look at sports-specific training and let's try to approach it from a common sense point of view. And if anything can get out tonight's session, it's not necessarily the content of the session, but more so the context of the session, is how to look at things through different eyes and to see it from a different view rather than seeing it through how everyone else is seeing it. Because what people tend to do is they tend to like to follow the crowd or follow the fashion or follow the trend. And before you know it, everyone's doing what everyone else is doing. Even if you look at group exercise, the big in thing at the moment, animal-based classes, you know, doing animal movements and running around like a bear or a bunny rabbit or a snake, who knows what they're doing, or monkeys. So everyone's doing it, but you know, no one's really actually looking at it and looking at it from virgin eyes and they're saying, well, you know, why are we doing this for, and what is the outcome, and does it really relate to the goal? And I've had quite an interesting journey in the area of sports specific conditioning, because that was and still is, I guess, to this day one of my deep passions. And I guess that's where I started in the profession. When I came out of as I was going through university, I've always been an athlete, and everything I did was always tried it related it to the sports that I participated in, but particularly, obviously, my martial arts. Everything was geared towards getting better at martial arts in the competitive level. So when I left university and we started working in gyms, so I started doing, obviously, teaching strength training and gym instruction, but my true passion was looking at strength training for elite athletes. And the interesting thing is, around that particular time, sporting teams weren't really... they didn't have strength and conditioning coaches. They didn't even have fitness coaches. You know, the coach sort of got the team to run around at the end of training, do sprints, do laps, and basically it was up to the individual to go and get fit and go and join some local bodybuilding gym and go into a bodybuilding Arnie Schwarzenegger type program combined with a Franco Colombo program. And it was really up to the athlete. But yeah, in the 80s, things started to, change in terms of the benefit of strength training for elite athletes, because it was probably seen at that time, back in those days, of, you know, strength training, and they looked at what strength training did to bodybuilders, and athletes thought, well, geez, I don't want to look like that, because A, that's not going to be practical for my sport. I'm going to become too big and too slow, because they looked at the bodybuilders, not taking into account the amount of chemical warfare and the things they sprinkled on their Weet-Bix at the time to get that abnormally large. And so a lot of athletes didn't do strength training purely because they thought it would make them slower. Even if you look at, the prime event in the Olympics, the 100-meter sprint, over the generations, if you go back in time, the sprinters were quite lean and certainly not muscular as they are today. I always remember watching the great Jamaican Don Quarry. I guess he was like the Usain Bolt of the day back in the 70s. And he used to run the 100 and 200. And, you know, he was quite skinny compared to even Usain Bolt, who's actually quite lean compared to most sprinters. And I always remember probably the most muscular 100-meter sprinter which I saw was, I think it was back in the 1976 Olympic Games in Moscow. And America boycotted those games because the USSR invaded Afghanistan in protest. They didn't go to those Olympics. They boycotted, but the winner of that was a guy from Scotland. I think it was Scotland or it was Wales. His name was Alan Wells was his name. And I always remember him being quite muscular compared to the sprinters. And if you compare him to the sprinters today, he was probably quite lean. And they said his strength training consisted of doing 100 push-ups a day. I always remember it, 100 push-ups a day, because I saw his little muscular arms. I said, that's it, I want to get arms like that. So I started doing push-ups and try to get to do my 100 push-ups a day. And unfortunately, I never end up looking like him, because obviously we come from different mothers. However, it was an interesting journey of looking at the 100-meter sprint. And then in the 80s came Carl Lewis, lean, and he, I guess he's, in, I think it's the 84 Olympics, he, or 80, 1980 Olympics in LA, that year the USSR, or Russia that it is now known today, boycotted those Olympics in retaliation to the US boycotting the Moscow Olympics. But he won the quadruple event. It hadn't been won since the great Jesse Owens back in 1936, which he won the 100, the 200, the long jump, and the 4x100 meters. So Carl Lewis was the hero of the time. He's a freaky athlete, one of the greatest athletes of all time. And then came along later in the 80s, came along this guy from Canada. And I guess it was around that time, and probably spurred on by him, I always remember, a guy called Ben Johnson. Now, I know he was originally disgraced by being tested positive for the... however, understand that at that particular time, everyone was taking it. He just got caught, as is, I guess, with the Tour de France, when, what's his name, Lance Armstrong got caught. You know, he just happened to be the one who got caught. Everyone else was taking it at the time. But Ben Johnson used to, he started utilizing a lot of heavy weight training and building his body up to become very explosive. And it was a really freaky thing. I mean, there hasn't been anyone like that since Usain Bolt is today, because he used to just crush the opposition. And he was so fast out of the blocks. Within, you know, 20 metres, he'd be 5 metres ahead. He just was lightning fast out. And one of the reasons why he was so fast out is because he used to do very heavy weight training. When he did win the Olympic Games in 1988 in Seoul, Korea, and he ended up getting disqualified when he got tested positive. But, you know, not take anyone who understands sport at that time, the knowing that everyone was taking the monkey juice. But he... I know going in those Olympics, it was reported that he was squatting 600 pound and bench pressing 400 pound. And if he competed in the World Powerlifting Championships at the time, he would have placed third in that year in powerlifting. So he really sort of just by, and he was coached by a guy called Charlie Francis, who was also linked to drugs and all that sort of stuff. And but the point, take the drugs aside, what he did, that he made everyone look at that weight training, and heavy weight training really made you fast and made you explosive, particularly out of the blocks, because where you have to take your body from a still position in the blocks and accelerate your body weight, which is, you know, around in the 80 kilo range, and accelerate it from a standing start, and you got enough ground contact time to express force, you're closer to your maximal force generation, because particularly at the start, once you get going, you can't express that amount of force due to the fact that your foot's not in contact with the ground long enough to express a high amount of force. So strength training in the 100-meter sprint is really important in the takeoff or the start. And he really made, I guess, people, scientists at the time, start to have another look at the benefits of strength training. And it was around that era in the 80s that and early 90s that some, you know, research started to take off. And in Australia, it was led by a couple of researchers, by the one gentleman who's now Professor Robert Newton, and another guy by the name of Wilson. And they used to do a lot of research down at the Southern Cross University down in Lismore, northern New South Wales. And they had a passion for strength training. Now, I happened to also go to university with Rob Newton previously to that. So at that time, my passion was just strength and conditioning. So I started to market myself, and I left my job. Well, I didn't leave. I got sacked, actually. But that's another story. I left my position as a gym instructor, and I started my company called Sports Elite. And so at that time, I wanted to train athletes. So when I started marketing myself, I started training athletes. And I just used, you know, try to use common sense, anatomy, physiology is the best I understood it at the time, and not to Not to mention that as I progressed, I got a clearer picture of the application of anatomy and physiology. In my early years, I was sort of learning and, I guess, watching and copying and watching and learning and applying, but not necessarily thinking for myself. So as I progressed, I started to subscribe to a journal in the United States, because there's nothing in Australia. There was nothing in Australia except for the initial research Rob Newton and Greg Wilson were doing down at the Southern Cross University. So I started subscribing to a journal called the Strength and Conditioning Journal. And it used to arrive in my mailbox every month, and I'd read through all the stuff they're doing over the United States. And obviously the United States has, 300 million people. And yeah, it's quite diverse, and there's people doing all sorts of stuff over there. So what is interesting, I guess, to explain my journey, as I was moving through, the more I got exposed to more stuff, the more stuff I started to apply. I guess it takes me back to my early days in bodybuilding. When I first started doing bodybuilding at age 17, I was taken under the lat of a bodybuilder by the name of Jeff Olson, from a Canadian bodybuilder, who was really very, his focus was just the big core lift. So I used to go to the gym with him. We just did simple core lifts, bench, squat, all the big moves. And we did it, not to mention, we did do a couple of little moves, but it was all the big moves that we used to do. And I put on a lot of muscle in that time. But what's interesting is the more I got hungry for knowledge, the more I learned. The more I learned, the more I started to apply, and the more complicated I made it. So before you know it, I'm starting to do these very complicated bodybuilding routines over time, because I started learning and being exposed to more stuff to do and not thinking about it, thinking, well, he's big, he's doing it, so I do what he does, therefore I must get big. And before I know it, I started doing all these really complicated bodybuilding routines and started getting diminishing returns in my training. The more complicated I made it, the less results I got. And I guess the same thing started happening in sports conditioning. The more I got exposed to plyometrics and power and ballistic weight training and dynamic weight training and death jumps and lateral hops and all these things that they started to play around with, and they started drawing things out of the Eastern Bloc countries back in when East Germany was a communist country, and behind the war, the Berlin War, they're doing all sorts of crazy stuff, juicing them up. So all these different training techniques came out. So I started applying them all. And before you know it, my program started getting more and more complicated. And I also felt the need that if I'm going to call myself an expert or specialist in strength and conditioning for sport, I felt that my programs had to look different to a normal basic program. If they're going to be paying me $50 to write a program, I can't just send them a program that looks like just a general gym instructor would write. It has to be wow, it has to be in Morse code or some form of code or complicated. So as I started learning about periodization and learning about an author called Bumper and periodization and researching this and researching that, before you know it, I had all these thousands of ideas going around in my head, not truly understanding them, but trying to put them together in some form of jigsaw puzzle, and started making these programs very, very complicated. And I guess, people thought, wow, I don't really understand this, but he must understand it, therefore he must know what he's doing. When really, if you had to question me from an anatomical point of view, I probably couldn't be able to justify it from an anatomical point of view. But, I was getting the accolades, and I was training athletes, and some of them were getting great results. And I understand that doing something is obviously going to be better than doing nothing in the short term anyway. Maybe in the long term, the stuff I was doing was leading them down the path to overtraining. So it was an interesting journey in reflection, until certain things started to occur, and I started to observe certain incidences that happened with my athletes, and I started thinking, that doesn't make sense. I always remember a couple of things that happened, and I guess, it goes back to Einstein's beautiful quote, an egotist will take something really simple and make it complicated. And I guess at that particular time in my career, I was an egotist full of ego, wanting to put myself at the top of the perch as if I'm the expert. No one can understand my programs because they're so scientifically designed that no one understands except me. But really, I just used to catch big words and throw them out there and attach them onto different training methods. Whereas Einstein says a genius would take something really complicated and make it simple, but I certainly wasn't in that place at that time. So as I moved through, certain things started happening. I always remember training. I was training the Olympic kayak team for the 1992 Barcelona Games. And yes, I used to train them, once again, in the gym 3 times a week, which, as we know now, was just far too much, but that's okay. I didn't know any different. But other strength and conditioning coaches would give them 5 times a week. So I was probably the less volume and the less frequent of the strength and conditioning coaches going around. Because I was one of the first. It was myself in Australia. I had Sports Elite, and there's another strength and conditioning coach called Ian King, who had a company called Sports Specific. And we were the only, at that time, the only two that I knew of. And we started up around about the same time. And he took a deep hatred towards me because I was his competition and very threatened. So I tried to annoy him by becoming more successful. The greatest revenge is massive success, is according to our Frank Sinatra. So what a couple of things happened. I was training, I always remember training them in the gym, the Olympic kayak team. And one of I heard, I was chatting to one of the athletes, and I hear this smashing noise behind me of weights hitting the ground and a scream. And that's not a good sound. You know, when you hear smashing weights followed by a human scream, that's not good. So straight away, I turn around with apprehension. And one of the kayakers had dropped the weight, and he was holding his shoulder as if he was in a sling. And what happened is the weight had collapsed, and he had lost control of it. And he had, looking back now, he had subluxed his shoulder. And I obviously thought he had dislocated at the time. But also understanding that the horror of the whole event was he was only 6 weeks out from the Olympic Games. So I'm thinking, oh no, he's in my gym, he's training for the Olympic Games. He was around 30 years of age, so this was going to be his last Olympics, his last hurrah. And first of all, you think, oh my gosh, I've just destroyed someone's dream. He's doing my exercise, he lost control, he's dislocated his shoulder joint, and that's the end of his Olympic dream. Fortunately, he did heal, and he ended up winning an Olympic silver medal. But what's the interesting thing is the exercise he was doing. At that time, he was doing a overhead tricep extension. So he had an easy bar, it was above his head, and he was doing overhead tricep extension. And obviously in that position, if you lose a little bit of control of the weight, your shoulder's already in a dislocation position. And when you take the weight behind your head, your shoulder's perfectly in a dislocation position. So it's not doesn't make any sense to do such an exercise. However, where did I get that exercise from? Well, in my latest journal, from the Strength and Conditioning Journal, I read this article by the U.S. canoe coach, and he wrote down his program of what he gave his canoeists, and obviously that exercise was in it, because his justification is that it worked the long-headed tricep. So you have to, because when you take your arm above your head, you get, because the long-headed tricep goes across the shoulder joint, because it originates from the lateral border of the scapula, and it inserts, it goes across the shoulder joint, across the elbow joint, and inserts onto the olecranon process on the ulna. Therefore, you get a pre-stretch in the long-headed tricep if you're working it more. And considering that kayaking or canoeing, you get extension of the shoulder joint. Therefore, one of the extensors of the shoulder joint that extends with your latissimus dorsi and your teres major and your deltoid is your long-headed tricep. So his justification was, yeah, we've got to pre-stretch it to so the long-headed tricep will get stronger for canoeing. But yeah, from a common sense point of view, I looked at the movement and says, what part of kayaking or canoeing is your arm above your head with a weight in it and you're taking your elbow behind your head to do the tricep? So straight away, a big light bulb went off. Unfortunately, I almost destroyed someone's dream to get that light bulb off. And I thought, that does not make any sense. Why am I doing that exercise and putting the competitor at risk of destroying his dream? So I guess that was one of the epiphanies, I suppose, that started changing my exercise selection of why I'm doing that exercise. When you look at kayaking, it's a complicated movement, but why try to break all the muscles down and put them in dysfunctional positions to train a muscle out of its normal position that it would be if you're kayaking? So, yeah, that was probably one of the first epiphanies or changes in view that I had. And around that time, power cleans were quite a big thing. They came into the theme, I suppose. You know, athletes need to do power, therefore they need to do power cleans. And around that time is when I started to take on the, I was also started my master's degree at Southern Cross University under the supervision of Professor Robert Newton. And we actually published a couple papers together, some research papers. And around that time, power cleans were coming in. I started to do some research in the laboratories with certain lifting techniques and so on. And what was interesting is I started actually getting kayakers to do the power clean around that time. And that's when I started looking. Says, what is a power clean got anything to do with kayaking when you're sitting in a kayak or canoe like a structure and you're paddling? And it's mostly a isotonic or even a there's not a lot of eccentric contraction. It's mostly just concentric in a isotonic type of isokinetic type contraction, where the more force you generate, the speed stays pretty much the same and the water hazard effect. So I'm looking at these power cleans, and they have nothing to do with kayaking. So it didn't make any sense, even anatomical, even common sense, movement patterns, biomechanics, physiology, didn't make any sense. And all I was doing is putting the health of the athletes at risk because they're doing these complicated lifts. And I guess the argument there was, you know, powerlifters or Olympic lifters are very explosive. Are they explosive because they do power cleans, or are they just naturally explosive, therefore they go into Olympic lifting? So to give a sport that is not Olympic lifting, power cleans didn't make any sense to me, because it's actually quite a complicated lift, particularly the catch. And you can do, if it's not done properly, you put a lot of strain through the lower back, you can put a lot of strain through the shoulder joint as well. And I didn't want to risk the health of my athletes. So at that time, I started eliminating these exercises, which I couldn't actually link in to a benefit in the sporting performance. But I guess, you know, a lot of athletes do a lot of stuff and they give credit to everything. I guess it's like the old philosophy: if a guy wants to lose weight, he goes for a half hour run every day, and after every run, he does 30 crunches and he starts losing weight. And you say, how do you lose weight? He says, oh, geez, those crunches are working. Well, many times, you know, the crunches weren't necessary. They're just an add-on. But because you feel it, because it's different, you give credit to it. It's same with bodybuilders. You know, they do the bench presses and they do the lat pull downs, but then they go and do tricep press downs and bicep curls. And he says, wow, your biceps and triceps are big. He says, yeah, those bicep curls and tricep extensions are working. Well, maybe they got the arms from the bench presses and the seated row, and doing those extra exercises are of no benefit. They just fill up space. They just fill up your time. And a lot of the time in training, I even see in today's environment in sports conditioning, you see all these athletes doing all these stuff, all these weird things, and sometimes you question, what has that got to do with Australian rules or rugby union, or what has that got to do with basketball, what has that got to do with martial arts? And they're filling all this training time up with stuff, so much stuff, they don't know what's actually giving them the benefit. Maybe what's giving them the benefit is just the core base stuff, and all the rest is just creating a bit of a repetitive strain on their body that could lead down to the path of diminishing returns, training plateaus, decrease in performance, and even eventually injuries. And we know that from sports conditioning. In sports conditioning injuries, you've got to be able to keep your players on the field. And that's one of the things I noticed even when I started working with the national baseball team. When I first started training with them, we used to do strength training 3 times a week. But after 6 years of working with them, by the end of that 6 years, I transformed my whole view. We were only just doing training once a week. At the start, in the start of the 6 years, I was doing buys and tries. At the end, the workouts were very short and brief. But they were getting better results anecdotally. Plus, the number of injuries was so far less. And I feel that a lot of the injuries that people get on the field actually are contributed to by what you do off the field. If you've got someone and you're training them in the gym 3 times a week, and then they go into the baseball field or the basketball court or the football field, and they do hardcore training on the field 4 times a week, then they go and play on the weekend, in very an environment full of adrenaline and energy, and they got a twing in the hamstring, then they're going to ding the ham, you know, do the hamstring or do the shoulder, but maybe they didn't tear it. Yes, they tore it on the field, but the process started off the field by overtraining them. And that's one of the interesting thing I find in baseball is people who did rotator cuff exercises seem to have rotator cuff injuries. Well, if you go into baseball and you're throwing the ball 50 to 100 times every training session at maximal velocity, then you go in the gym and do rotator cuff exercises. Well, your rotator cuff is just taking a bashing out in the field, and probably what it needs is rest and a bit of light stretching so it regenerates in a lengthened position rather than going to the gym and start overloading it and doing more repetitive strain on it with an overload. So a lot of the time it's like a swimmer who goes in the pool and he does laps and laps and laps and laps. Then he goes in the gym and he's already prone to rotator cuff injuries, such as a baseball player. Then you put him in the gym and you start to mimic the sporting action of the swimming action in the gym. And all you're doing is you're putting more repetitive strain on the rotator cuff or those smaller stabilizing muscle groups, no matter what the sport is. But they feel they need to do that. And the other interesting thing is trying to replicate a complex sporting action in the gym is an interesting thing to do. You know, how can you replicate the complex circumduction movement with the specific technique of a swimming action or a cricket bowl or a baseball pitch or swinging of a baseball bat or a cricket bat? How can you mimic that in the gym? The only you just can't biomechanically. And then you overload it, and all you're doing is creating a long lever with a load at the end of a lever, creating a high amount of inertial forces through the joints, which are already susceptible to injury because they're joints that move with long levers with velocity, that are also prone to injury because they've already been overtrained, probably been used in their sporting performance or sports training, and then you go and try to do that. So even though the intent is good, when do those smaller physical structures of the body get to recover so it can recover for the next game or the next training session? And, you know, athletes, they're so determined to win, they'll keep pushing and pushing and pushing until something breaks. And what I found is myself is maybe I was being a strength and conditioning coach. I was the one who's supposed to improve their performance and minimize their injuries. Where actually I was over time, in the short term, I was increasing performance because doing something will always get an increase. But long term, I was probably over time diminishing performance and increasing the chances of injury due to me putting them in a position of overtraining. You know, so I always remember the body has to recover. Otherwise, if you keep training it and it's not recovering, then you will go down the path of overtraining, diminishing returns, a training plateau, a decrease in performance, and then a injury. And if you don't let that injury, then that will lead to tendonitis, level 1, level 2, level 3, stage 4 tendonitis, where it becomes irreparable. So you want to make sure as a strength coach that you're not contributing to the problem by giving them a sport-specific program, when really they probably just need to have a bit of rest, stew to get those physical structures, the muscles strong while protecting the joint. Where if you try to train those muscles specific to the sporting action, you actually put more strain on the joints. So it is interesting is that when you look at the common sense, I always remember presenting at the National Strength and Conditioning Association, the National Coaching Conference in Australia at the Australian Institute of Sport. There was 200 of the elite strength and conditioning coaches, and I was presenting on a presentation on increased performance, train less was the topic. And I started by saying if you had a 100-meter sprinter, and you obviously at that time we all knew that any power-based type sport, strength training is going to be of benefit. We got into the 90s now where strength training was of benefit. Linford Christie was the next 100-meter sprinter from Great Britain who started cleaning up the 100-meter sprint in the Olympics, and he was just a big unit. He was big and fast and powerful. As just recently, Usain Bolt, in his last race at the World Championships, he just got beaten by the American Gatlin. If you have a look at Gatlin's physique, you know, he could almost compete in a bodybuilding contest. You know, just short and muscular and powerful. So what's interesting is that, I was presenting on strength training, increase your performance, train less. And I asked, if you had a 100-meter sprinter and you were leading them into the Olympic Games, how far out from the Olympic Games would you start tapering the strength training? And how much complete rest off the strength training would you give your Olympic sprinter so the body, their body is fully recovered, fully regenerated, fully overcompensated? So on that Olympic day of the final, when they're racing for the gold medal, they're going to be at peak performance. How long would you give them off strength training? And what was interesting is that the answer was anywhere between 1 to 4 weeks. On average, out of 200 of the elite strength trainers, they all said probably 2 weeks. So then my question was, okay, so if we acknowledge that you're going to give your sprinter 2 weeks recovery from high-intense weight training so their muscles fully regenerate, fully recover, and fully overcompensate, we're now acknowledging that it takes 2 weeks for a muscle to fully recover, fully regenerate from its previous last heavy weight training session. So if that is the case, if it takes 2 weeks to recover, then why do we put that same athlete in the gym before that 1 week or 2 weeks before the Olympics and get him to do weight training 3 times a week when you've just acknowledged it takes 2 weeks for the body to fully recover? Wouldn't you just strength training at the elite level every 2 weeks so that every time they go in the gym, they're fully recovered? So obviously, there was a certainly uncomfortable silence that went through the room, and no one could actually give any logical answer. Because we already know that muscle soreness and muscle regeneration, even at the microscopic level, can take, at the elite level, can take up to 21 days for the muscle to fully regenerate for doing high intense weight training. So you, using all that science and that common sense, that's where I personally started to strength train my athletes one session a week with good compound exercises. That way I had plenty of time to recover. It freed up more time for them to do other activities, whether it be getting a massage or getting therapy or doing skilled training or doing flexibility or actually playing their sport. That way they were always fresh when they trained. They weren't dragging their heels. I always remember a colleague of mine was a strength coach for the Gold Coast Rollers at the time, which was a national basketball team that competes in the Australian League, the ones that the Breakers play in. But he had a whole different approach to strength training than me. He used to give his players high volume. And the Claxton, the coach at the time, forced his players to go in the gym 3 times a week. And they would, you know, one of the exercises, they had to do 10 sets of 10 chin-ups. You know, to that doesn't make any sense. Why don't you just do one set as many as you can rather than do, why would you drag it out 10 sets of 10? I don't know. He just got that out of some muscle-building magazine. But what was interesting is that one of the guys who was the captain of the team, who was a colleague of mine and a friend of mine called Larry Senstock, and we went to university together because he did his a degree at the same place I did at the University of Queensland. And what I noticed, because I used to train people in the same gym, that these basketballers would come in, and obviously it's easy to see them because they're all about 6'5", 6'9", and they would come in, and the strength coach wasn't there, but they had to come in and do a workout. So they'd come in, go walk up to the filing cabinet, grab their training card, fill out their training card, put their card back in, and walk back out again. And I noticed that they weren't actually training. They're filling out the card as if they're trained, but they weren't actually training. And when the coach was there, they would train, but they wouldn't train very hard. And I always remember asking Larry, I said, so I noticed a lot of the players, they come in here, they fill out the card, but they don't actually do anything. They just fill out the card as if they've done it. And he says, well, I said, K-Man, you know, if you look at our schedule, we, Claxton, our coach, he really pushes us hard in the court. So we do 4 days a week of court training, and it's really high impact stuff, basketball. As you know, it's very explosive, very, has a high impact. We get drilled to the death on the court. Then we go on a tour and we play 2 games on a weekend. Then they expect us to come in here and lift heavy weight training with all these Olympic power cleans and Olympic lifts, where it's like teaching a praying mantis an Olympic lift with these our long limbs, and they expect us to do heavy weight training three times a week. You crazy? So obviously they're not going to compromise their basketball, so they just would fill out their card. So another little light bulb went off is that, you know, don't push these athletes across. If you push them too much, they will break down, and they're no good off the court, particularly when they're getting paid good money or they're going for a big title. So it was interesting in that journey of that I started to look at, you know, how can I make strength training a supplement? Don't let it take over the sport. You shouldn't have to wedge your sport into the strength training. You should be able to wedge the strength training into the sport. And when you put it into the weekly schedule or the fortnightly schedule, where can I put that high-intense strength training session so there's enough time after where they're going to recover? They're not going to go and do strength training the next day they're really sore and they go and do hill sprints or do high-intense court training, whatever it might be. Where can I put it where I can maximize the recovery that doesn't hinder the training of their sport, doesn't lead them down the path of overtraining, and they always feel as fresh as possible to train, where they're not actually always overcoming niggling injuries and tight muscles. And yes, I understand sport, you will get niggling injuries and tight muscles, but you want to make sure that comes from playing the sport, not from your strength training program. Your program is supposed to add value to their sport, not take away value. You're supposed to add performance to their sport, not take away performance from their sport. So, you know, there's two avenues, or there's two thoughts in strength training, I guess, currently. I used to be the person who used to try to make sport-specific strength training very specific to the sport. So I used to try to mimic different actions and look at the force-velocity curves and the acceleration, the biomechanical movement, and how can I replicate that in the gym, yada, yada, yada. And what I found with that, it just made things very complicated, made them long, made them boring, made them tedious, made them overtrained, and actually promoted injuries. And a lot of the time was just a waste of time. That's my opinion anyway. But I've been there, I've done that. And I've transferred over that time to the end where I was just doing, let's get the person to get them strong in the gym. So the purpose of the gym is to get them strong. So let's put them in a strong position to do a strong weight, to do a strong lift to get a strong result while protecting the joint. We're here to make the muscles strong without wearing out the tendons and without wearing out the joint. And the last thing we want to do is overtrain them. So it has to be the KISS principle. Keep it simple and short. Quality, and if they're going to do any volume of work, the volume of work they should be doing is throwing baseballs or serving tennis balls or running around the football field, because that's where they need the volume, if anything, and that's where they're going to get the specificity. I realize you can't replicate the swimming action, the bowling action, the pitching action, the kicking action, the running action, the scrumming action. You can't even come close to biomechanically replicate that, or the force, or the acceleration, or the angles, or the stability in the gym. It's just silly. You're better off just hopping in the pool and swimming, throwing some more baseballs, throwing some more punches. You know, do on the field, do on the court, do on the pool what's best done in the pool, on the court, on the field. And that is the specific movement. Do in the gym what's best done in the gym, which is good basic strength training. Because what I do know, I cannot fatigue someone's muscle to 100% fatigue, volitional failure, on the field in the pool. You know, because the force isn't, you can't generate enough force because the load's not there. The water doesn't apply a load. The air doesn't apply a load. The floor doesn't apply a load. The ground doesn't apply a load. The tennis racket doesn't apply a load. The board doesn't apply a load. And the load is constant. The weight of the tennis racket is constant. The weight of your body weight pushing on the ground is constant. It's the same load. All you can do is try to accelerate, but you're going to be limited in what you can accelerate anyway. But in the gym, I can adapt the load. I can adapt the environment. I can put more weight on the bar. I can put more weight on the dumbbell. Now I can control it, and I can increase it, and I can activate muscle fibers, fast-twitch muscle fibers that I've never activated before, because I can't generate that amount of force off the ground, off a tennis racket, off a baseball, off a cricket bat. I can't generate that amount of force, but I can in the gym. I can control the force in the gym. So what I do in the gym is I go do basic movements, maximize force generation, while putting the body in a strong, safe position, because it's no use injuring them in the gym because they're no good on the field. And then when they're strong, activating the fast twitch muscle fibers, and even though the movement is slow, if I'm doing a bench press with a heavy weight, the movement's slow, but the intent is fast. Because when I'm lifting a heavy weight off my chest, the muscles are trying to push as hard or contract as fast as they can to get the weight up. So the resultant movement is slow, but the intent of the firing of the motor units and the frequency of firing the motor units is fast. And that's why all the research shows just doing core strength training improves power production. One of the studies I did was looking at the benefits of doing just a basic strength training versus plyometric training, and is using baseballers, and I looked at baseball velocity, baseball throwing velocity. So one group did a bench press and a barbell pullover. Now I wouldn't normally recommend a pullover, but I had to try to keep the movement pattern similar to the explosive plyometric group, because the explosive plyometric group, I got them to do medicine ball explosive chest passes as far as they can throw it, and overhead throws. So those two movement patterns are similar to a bench press and similar to a pullover. But the bench press and the pullover, I can control the force by increasing the load. The medicine ball, the weight was constant, but I got them to explode it like we do plyometric type training. Because that was one of the, that's a very popular training method in explosive sports, is doing medicine ball training. And at that time, there's not one publication, not one scientific publication ever been published in any recognized scientific journal that shows that's ever been studied on medicine ball training, let alone if there's any benefit. So obviously, I decided to be the first, so I ended up publishing it in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. And what I found is, well, after 10 weeks of training, the group that was doing the constant strength training with progressive overload increased their throwing velocity. The group that did the plyometric training with the medicine ball didn't improve their throwing velocity because they didn't increase their strength. Their strength didn't go up because I measured their strength. The strength of the traditional weight training group went up. The other observation is the medicine ball group, they had more injuries because they're trying to explode this weight, trying to get the movement similar to a baseball throw, but they were just getting injured. So it was an interesting observation of just keeping it simple and strong and let the practice of the throwing movement take care of the specificity. Now, I do know there are some strength coaches try to make it more complicated. And I see them doing little foot tappy dances through little ladders and jumping over medicine of little witches' hats and running in between hoops and all sorts of stuff. And sometimes I think, what has this got to do with the sport? Think of the actions in the sport and think, is there something better I can do that makes more has a direct, more of a relationship to the sporting action, which is going to be more specific, more simple, so I can generate more power, more velocity, or more force in a simple movement, rather than trying to make it complicated by doing power cleans and snatches and plyometric hops and jumps and all sorts of stuff. And all you're doing is increasing the repetitive strain on the athlete. So there's two lines of thought. My line of thought is doing the gym what's best done in the gym, which generate good basic strength, protecting the joints, rehabilitating the muscles, stretching the muscles, and let the sport take care of the specificity. The other line of thought is that some strength and conditioning coaches try to replicate the movement in the gym and do all sorts of stuff because they're trying to generate velocity and power and specificity. I always remember Ro and I went down to the Australian Institute of Sport. This is many years after I had moved on from being a strength coach there. And one of my colleagues is a physiologist. He had a PhD in physiology. So he's taking us through a tour, and we're in with the swimmers. And the swimmers were doing, in the gym though, doing Olympic lifts. And I said, what has the Olympic lift got to do with swimming? And he says, oh yeah, it generates power and velocity. And I said, okay, so what is this? Well, what stroke does this guy do? He said, oh, he's a breaststroker. And if you look at the Olympic lift, such as a power clean, and you look at that movement, and then you look at the movement of doing a breaststroke in a pool, and if you can see anything that is even remotely related, then I'm a monkey's bum. And I thought, wow, why are they doing this? Well, the reason why they're doing it, because the head strength and conditioning coach, who's also a colleague of mine, he was a former Olympic lifter. So guess what? He started teaching them what? The only thing he knew. So it's interesting thoughts is that everyone has their own view. But you know, a lot of the sports I work with, I've never played their sport. I've never played baseball. I've never been a kayaker. And I think that's been an advantage because I haven't been affected by tradition, or this is why it's always been done. So I've never been affected by tradition. I've always looked at it through virgin eyes and looked at purely from an anatomical, physiological, biomechanical point of view, and most of all, rep with a lot of common sense. And I'm not to say that I used to fall into that trap of trying to think, make things complicated in my early career, but now I just try to make things a lot more simple. And even to this day, with my martial arts and the world titles, I just say, well, how is this going to, this training, how's this going to help me? Is there something better I can do, whether it be training or recovery? So when you look at any sport, try to look at it from remove tradition, remove all the noise, all the fancy train techniques, all the toys, all the ladders and the hoops and the pom poms and all the stuff that you get these days, and just look at the sporting motion, look at the energy systems, look at the muscles that are involved, look at the fiber types, fast, slow twitch fibers, look at the acceleration, look at the power production, look at the strength requirements. Look at how much strength do they need to overcome the weight of that implement? How fast do they need to express it? Look at the skill, look at the stability, and think, okay, so how can I train this person so they can be strong and reduce the chances of injury so they can keep playing this sport? And I think one of the best things for strength training personally is that it just reduces the chances of injury by keeping all your muscles strong and gives them the recovery. But make sure you don't overcook the turkey where you start doing high volume and high frequency strength training, because that will have the opposite effect and lead you down that path of complexity, high volume, high repetition, high amounts of repetitive strain that leads to, as I shared before, diminishing returns, training plateaus, decrease in performance, and eventually injury. And unfortunately, I've injured athletes through my ignorance. And you try not to do that, and you try to learn from that. So the one thing is that even with an athlete, you have to keep them safe and keep them playing the game. Otherwise, an athlete who's injured does not win.